Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our West Coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry.
Those 100,000 Japanese Americans were ultimately sent to internment camps scattered throughout the U.S., often in the most desolate areas. One camp was in Heart Mountain, Wyoming, and before the war ended, nearly 14,000 Japanese Americans were imprisoned there. This past weekend, the camp opened as a museum, the Heart Mountain Interpretive Learning Center, and some of those internees returned to Heart Mountain for the first time in more than 60 years. This hour on Point, the history of Japanese-American internment. You can join the conversation, listeners. How well do you know the story of Japanese-American internment? Were you an internee yourself? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. You can see photos of Heart Mountain and see vintage clips of the Japanese-American internment on our website as well. Joining me first from Salt Lake City, Utah, to talk about the history of the internment and Heart Mountain is Shirley Ann Higuchi. She's the chair of the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation Board of Directors and was a driving force behind the opening of the Learning Center. Shirley's parents were internees at Heart Mountain. Welcome, Shirley Ann. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
And from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Eric Muller also joins us. He is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina. He's written two books about Japanese internment, including American Inquisition, The Hunt for Japanese-American Disloyalty in World War II. He is co-chair of the Heart Mountain Program Committee and helped shape the Learning Center's exhibitions. Hello to you, Eric. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you very much for having me.
Shirley, let me begin with you. Describe for us, first off, exactly where Heart Mountain is.
Heart Mountain is located in between the cities of Powell and Cody in Park County, Wyoming. As one can imagine, there's a lot of farmland there, and the area is pretty dry, but there is farming. It is a farming community. We actually have barley now growing right outside our Interpretive Learning Center.
And when was this center built originally?
Well, the center, the center began building over the last couple of years. I mean, this was the grand opening. The site has been there for quite a while and has been memorialized over the years. But this is, the actual building actually was opened last weekend.
And the internment center was built when?
When was actually created for the Japanese Americans
yes,
in 1942, yes.
1942. And how many lived at Heart Mountain over the years that it was open?
Eric, you may have a better sense of that final number. I think the number that we had talked about has been, what, 20,000?
Well, there's two different numbers here, actually. One is the maximum population at any one time, and that was about 10,700, which made it actually the third largest population center in Wyoming. But over the 3 years that it was open, more than 14,000, just over 14,000 people of Japanese ancestry moved through the camp and were there for at least some period of time.
Eric Muller, take us through history here, and for some listeners who may not know about America's Japanese internment camps, help us understand the circumstances in this country that led to those internments, the imprisonment, essentially, of nearly 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry.
Well, just to put it into a nutshell, Jane, there's sort of some longer-term causes and then some shorter-term causes. The longer-term causes had a lot to do with the kinds of racism that were very prevalent in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century against Asians generally and people from Japan in particular. There was a long history of the so-called yellow peril, you know, the view that that the people of Asian ancestry were somehow basically genetically different from Americans, from white Americans, of course, and in some ways inferior and incapable of assimilating into American culture. There was also a long history of great Japanese American success along the West Coast, particularly in farming. The Japanese had become extremely successful as so-called truck farmers, you know, sort of vegetable farming. And that had triggered a great deal of resentment among white agricultural interests along the coast. But then, of course, we have to also mention the increasing belligerence of Japan, the Japanese Empire, in the 20s and 30s, which posed a military threat of various kinds to American interests in the Pacific. And then, of course, the sneak attack on December 7, 1941 in Pearl Harbor, which launched the United States into war with Japan. That created a kind of mix, a kind of toxic mix that unleashed powerful political forces that ended up leading the military to advocate for and get from President Roosevelt the authority to remove every person of Japanese ancestry from the coast.
Right. So February 19th, 1942, of course, as you say, in the aftermath of the attack on Pearl Harbor, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed this executive order, Executive Order 9066, which did what?
That order gave carte blanche to the military commander along the West Coast, a general named John DeWitt, to remove any and all persons from zones that he had the discretion to declare. And what he did with that carte blanche was to create a very racially selective removal of people from a very wide strip, in fact, the entire coastal strip, removing every person of Japanese ancestry, regardless of whether they were a resident alien or a United States citizen, from that coastal strip and forcing them into imprisonment, first along the coast and then in the summer of 1942, moving them out to places like Heart Mountain. Jane, let me just briefly say that there were also far more targeted actions taken against aliens from Germany and from Italy. So there were internments of German aliens and Italian aliens, but those were far more selective. They were accompanied by due process in the sense that people actually got hearings, and they did not cross the divide between aliens and citizens. So there was no mass action taken against German-American citizens or against Italian-American citizens. Mm-hmm. And that's a basic distinction between the treatment of Germans and Italians and Japanese.
So about 120,000 people, you say, of Japanese ancestry, is that correct, were literally rounded up and taken to these, quote, relocation centers?
That's correct. Two-thirds of them were U.S. citizens by virtue of having been born in the United States. They were first taken to a group of what were called assembly centers along the West Coast, which were basically fairgrounds and racetracks that were turned overnight into prison camps. And then in the summer of 1942, the government went searching for locations in the interior where it could build more permanent camps. Heart Mountain ended up being one of those 10 sites. And so in August of 1942, people began getting put on trains along the West Coast and moved from the assembly centers to these more permanent facilities and began arriving at Heart Mountain in August of 42.
Shirley Higuchi, two of those internees were your parents, weren't they?
Yes.
And so Heart Mountain has particular significance to you. Tell us about it.
Well, it has a tremendous amount of significance, Jane. And I just to echo sort of the train ride, I was talking to my father the other day, and when we were at Heart Mountain last weekend, he said it was, I think, about a three-day train ride or so. I mean, it's a pretty long journey from San Jose to Powell, Wyoming, but they were first put in a racetrack at Santa Anita Racetrack before they were actually moved into their permanent campsite at Heart Mountain.
In horse stables, right?
In horse stables, yes. And they had a pretty good life. I mean, my dad was from a farm community in San Jose. They actually owned their own land and were very successful in raspberries and strawberries and things like that. And my mother was a city girl from San Francisco, and they were successful merchants. And they had to get rid of everything, you know, really very quickly. Sell everything and make some very stressful decisions. So my significant ties to the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation is that my parents met there as children. And if you attend the museum, there's actually a large cutout photograph of my parents as kids. I guess they were in the ninth grade sitting next to each other. But, you know, but for that Japanese-American internment experience, I wouldn't be talking to you right now because they met there. They didn't stay in contact, and they bumped into each other years later at Berkeley.
As we say, the opening of the new Heart Mountain Center was this past weekend. I know your mother has recently passed, but I'm curious, was it difficult for many of these Japanese-Americans to return to this place? Because I know many had vowed never to go back.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a bittersweet situation. I think for most of the internees, like my father, it was a very serious moment. I think it was great that we had the support of the local community, as well as having Tom Brokaw there and Senator Inouye and Al Simpson and Norm Mineta to support us and really reinforce the value of why we were celebrating this moment. But I could safely say it was bittersweet. For me, it was. I mean, I think in many moments we saw the former internees now in their 80s, you know, weeping. I know I kind of broke a tear or two a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Eric might have cried too. Toshi, you might have. And it's just was a highly emotional experience because it really brought back past memories, not only of what happened to our parents and grandparents, but it also reminded me a lot of what my mother's dream was, which was to see this interpretive learning center built.
And much of her money, her fortune when she passed was given to this museum, was it not?
Well, our past and our current fortune has been geared towards this, but it's just not our family. I mean, you know, we've really had a significant support from the state and local and federal grant programs, as well as individuals and foundations, so we're very grateful.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Heart Mountain, Wyoming this hour, the site of a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II, which housed thousands of Japanese-Americans over the course of the war. We're joined this hour by Shirley Ann Higuchi. She's the chair of the Heart Mountain, Wyoming Foundation Board of Directors and was a driving force behind the opening of the Learning Center. Shirley's parents were internees at Heart Mountain. And by Eric Muller, professor of law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's co-chair of the Heart Mountain Program Committee. As you walk through the Heart Mountain Interpretive Learning Center, you're able to hear audio clips within the exhibit spaces. And I want to play one clip in the front of the museum's barracks. It's a recreated conversation between family members first arriving at Heart Mountain.
Is
this it?
How are we going to fit the whole family in this one room?
Eric, walk us through the Heart Mountain Interpretive Learning Center. What do you see? What do visitors see? What do they experience there?
Well, the experience of visiting the Interpretive Learning Center is to some extent our effort to try to capture some aspects of what it might have felt like to be at Heart Mountain as an internee back 60 years ago. When you walk into the museum, the first thing you're confronted with is a telephone pole with the so-called evacuation notice, the notice that was placed all over the West Coast telling Japanese-American families that they had a week or 2 weeks to clear out. From there, the visitor walks into exhibits that first deal with what life was like for Japanese Americans before the war. Visitors are then ushered into a theater to see our introductory film that was made for us by an Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker named Stephen Okazaki, whose father was a Heart Mountain internee. And from there, visitors move through out of the theater into an area that focuses on the forced removal of Japanese Americans from their homes, takes the visitor through various aspects of life in camp at Heart Mountain. Very central to the exhibit is the space that from which you just played the ambient audio, and that is two recreated barrack rooms. One of them set up to look just like a barrack room would have looked like in August of 1942 when a family first arrived. And the other one, just next to it, set up to look like it might have looked a couple of years later when a resourceful Japanese-American family tried their best to turn it into a more of a livable space. Towards the end of the exhibit, there is very important material about what it was like to leave camp and the very difficult decade or so that Japanese-American families had after they left Heart Mountain, trying to put their lives back together. And then finally, visitors move into a room that is more about the legacy of this experience in terms of what lessons it can teach us in our lives today and in future challenges that the country may face.
We'll hear from an internee who was there in just a couple of minutes. But Shirley, tell me what was most moving to you in the Interpretive Learning Center.
Well, everything was extremely moving for me. But I think in terms of what really hit hard for me were the barracks. There are two different barracks that are on display. One is what the barracks looked like when they first got to Heart Mountain. It was completely empty and very barren. And then over the years, the resilience of the Japanese Americans, you know, made themselves very creative by developing, you know, little tools and desks and curtains made out of makeshift discarded materials. So they have a before and after barrack, and that really struck me as being very important. I think the most significant aspect for me is the reflection garden, where I did work with Eric and others to develop a memorial plaque to my Issei grandparents on my father and mother's side, and also the Nisei children, and were able to sort of indicate where they were during the war. And then we dedicated it to them from the children and grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren. So that meant a lot.
Let me bring in a friend of you both, Toshi Ito. She's a former internee at Heart Mountain in Wyoming. She was actually raised in Los Angeles and was sent to the camp with her parents when she was 17 years old. She's now 86, and she joins me from Laguna Woods, California. Toshi Ito, welcome to On Point. I'm so happy that you're with us.
Hi, Jane, and hi, Eric, and hi, Shirley.
Hello, Toshi.
You were just all at the museum opening last weekend. You saw each other, right?
Yes, we did.
How was that experience for you, Toshi?
As Shirley said, it was bittersweet. At the same time, it was exhilarating. And I'm still on cloud nine, Eric and Shirley.
Why exhilarating, Toshi? Tell me.
Because to see the finished museum, I mean, you know, we worked 2 years to get the museum built and filled, and it took a lot of work and a lot of planning and many meetings, and at any rate, it was exhilarating to see the finished product, you might say.
Well, take us back many years, 1942, when you left California with your parents on a train to Heart Mountain. Do you remember that train ride?
Oh, do I ever. You know, the government sent World War I vintage train to take us to Heart Mountain. I say that because it was an old Santa Fe coal-burning train that had gas lights. Even I had not seen gas lights before till that day that we got on that train. At night, the train conductor would bring a torch and light the gas lights in our cars.
You were 17 years old.
Yes.
You're getting on this train. Do you know where you're going? And
no,
you have no idea.
Where we were being sent.
And what was your first thought when you get out after 2-3 days train ride and you get to this camp? What are you thinking?
We were so exhausted, but we were so glad to get off that train. And the wind was blowing and the dust was blowing. And all we wanted to do was head for the showers and to bed. And so that's what we did. We hit the showers, and then we went to bed. We didn't make our bed. We just put the mattress on the cot, steel cot, and just went to sleep.
Well, this is not hotel living. I mean, these weren't showers as in, you know, Holiday Inn. I mean, this was pretty rough. Can you describe what it looked like?
Well, it was a barren room, and it didn't even have insulated walls. And so and there were steel cots, three steel cots, and three mattresses. That's all. And our door wouldn't close. So eventually my father had to send for tools and fix the door so it would close.
And did you know how long you would be there? What were you told about why you were there and when you might go?
Well, we were there for the duration of the war. We knew that we couldn't get out until the war ended. But eventually, they did have leaves for the internees, and some left on labor leaves, such as working in picking vegetables and fruits.
And you left on a college leave, right? How did that happen?
I went on a college leave.
For how long?
For 3 years, but I came back to Harp Mountain the first summer and spent 3 months in Harp Mountain. Mm. And then I did not come back the first Christmas, but I came back the second Christmas and spent my Christmas holiday and New Year's with my parents in Harp Mountain. Mm.
One thing you packed with you to Harp Mountain was a pair of red boots.
Yes, it was.
Tell me about them.
All right. My father read the executive order saying that we would have to pack up our things and go to camp. So my father surmised that it would be in a very cold area. And so he sent my mother and me to buy boots. And so we had the boots when we were in Harp Mountain.
And your sister-in-law packed an American flag. Was there still patriotism in the midst of what was happening to you?
Yes. And it is such a heartwarming story. It was told in the documentary that Stephen Okazaki made, that my sister-in-law packed, of all things, the American flag. You know, she had only just one suitcase to put her clothes in, and yet she made room for that American flag.
And can I just jump in, Jane, and say that we're very, very proud that that American flag actually hangs on the wall of the barrack room at the Harp Mountain Interpretive Learning Center.
It does, indeed.
Let me get a couple of listeners in here who'd like to join us. Miyoko is calling from Vermont. It's nice to have you with us. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane, and I want to thank all of your guests for finally making this all happen. I'm a fourth-generation Japanese-American as well as Chinese-American, and I can speak from, in terms of Harp Mountain, it's really dear to my heart because my great-grandparents, my grandparents and my aunt and uncle, my father were born in Harp Mountain, and so they for me to learn about the story, it's not in the history books, but it took a long time for me to kind of learn the story about the internment camps. And
did they ever speak to you about it? What did they tell you?
They told me a lot about what the conditions. My grandmother tells me about the conditions of the camp, and what I find amazing, with particularly with the Nisei generation, is that how much their patriotism and the extent of their patriotism to the U.S. Was contrary to what I think the U.S. thought of them as enemies to the country. My grandmother and her siblings were kind of they were very patriotic, did everything American, and they firmly believe that maybe this was the right thing to do, to intern them because for their own safety. Whereas my father, who was born into the camps, several years later, is, of course, this anger of questions of why were we put in these camps and why did I have to be born in a camp? And I think that was the third generation really worked on the whole reparations aspect, but it really took a lot for them to speak up.
I'm so happy that you called. Thank you very much. Shirley, let me ask you about that because, of course, Toshi tells the story of her sister-in-law carrying the flag, and then we hear our caller, Miyako, talking about that patriotism. Was that common? Your parents were there. What do you remember?
Well, from what my parents have told me is that they were very patriotic. And my mother, in fact, in some ways kind of painted a very positive picture of camp, the fact that she had friends there and that she met my father there as a young girl. But I think there was always like a sort of a silence about what really happened there. And if the author Bill Hosokawa, The Quiet American, is a book he wrote, the Niseis were definitely quiet. And I think as our guest caller had mentioned, that it took a while to get some of the information out. And so that's why I think it's a very complex emotional experience right now, is that we're now processing essentially what happened in 1942.
Right.
And it's pretty tough.
Eric Muller, Toshi talked about life in the camp. I'm curious, was life similar for the most part, camp to camp, in these American, for these Japanese Americans?
Well, the the camps were, for the most part, in the Mountain West. There were two camps actually as far east as Arkansas, and so those camps, I think, probably would have been a whole lot more humid and infested with mosquitoes than what Toshi probably experienced.
But Heart Mountain was sure cold. Yeah.
It sure was cold. Yeah. It was sure, and it was sure hot too. You know, in the summertime, sure. It gets quite hot.
Let me ask you, Eric, quickly, because we're going to a break here, and I want to get this in, because one thing that interested me when you say that many of the camps had swing bands during the time that the Japanese Americans were there, and a favorite tune that was sung, "Don't Fence Me In," I assume was for ironic value. Is that right, Eric?
That's my understanding, You see some references to that in the Heart Mountain Sentinel as well, which was the camp newspaper that was published. Toshi might have some direct memories of that swing band.
Toshi, do you remember that song being played
and
the swing bands? Yeah.
"Don't fence me in," and here we were fenced in.
We also played the song at the reunion last Friday.
You played it at the opening of the Interpretive Learning Center.
Yes, we had a young Yonsei singer who is related to Jeanette Misaka on our program committee, and she's saying, "Don't Fence Me In." And I think the reason why the group chose that song is to add a little bit of humor and irony to the whole experience, just like Toshi noted.
You must have had to have had a lot of humor in the middle of this, Toshi. Did you and your family?
Well, yes. We had to make the best of the situation, you know. And it's useless to be negative, so you have to look on the positive side.
My guest this hour, Toshi Ito, joining me from California. She's a former internee at Heart Mountain in Wyoming. She went to the camp with her parents when she was 17. Eric Muller is professor of law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's co-chair of the Heart Mountain Program Committee and author of two books on the Japanese-American experience in those camps. And Shirley Ann Higuchi, chair of the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation Board of Directors, who has spent a good deal of her life these last few years trying to get this center opened. We'll talk with all of our guests again after the break, and you listeners. We're going to go out into this break with Ella Fitzgerald's "Don't Fence Me In," a popular song, an ironic song that played at many of the internment camps during that time. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Send me off forever, but I ask you, please, don't fence me in. Just turn me loose. Let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western skies. On my cayuse, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise. I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences. Gaze at the moon till I lose my senses. Can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Heart Mountain, Wyoming this hour. During World War II, it was the site of a Japanese-American internment camp. And today, it is the Heart Mountain Interpretive Learning Center. It is open to the public. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And you can see a photo gallery of Heart Mountain and view vintage clips of the Japanese-American internment by going to our website. Let's go right to the phones. So many callers lined up. Mark is first from Rock Springs, Wyoming. So nice that you called, Mark. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hello. Go ahead.
There's a great story that former Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson tells. Of course, he grew up in Cody, Wyoming, and he was a young boy during the era of the Heart Mountain Camp. And he tells a story about meeting Norman Mineta, who, of course, was the transportation secretary under President Clinton. They met as Cub Scouts at Heart Mountain. Apparently, there was a Cub Scout den in the camp, and Senator Simpson's dad came and visited them at Heart Mountain, and they got to know each other a little bit, and then, of course, met again many years later in Washington, D.C., as they were both both there serving their state. That's kind of a favorite story that's gets told around the state here.
It is a good story, and thanks for telling it, Mark. I'm glad you called from Rock Springs, Wyoming. Thanks. Toshi Ito, tell me how you spent your days at Heart Mountain when you were there. What was the average day like?
Well, the average day is you get up and you have to go to the latrine to brush your teeth and wash your face, and then you line up and go to the mess hall and line up for your breakfast. And then since I didn't attend school at that time, it was summertime anyway, and so I would go home and...
back to the barrack.
Yes.
And?
My father had... subscribed to Book of the Month Club, and so I would read some books. And then it was lunchtime, and line up again. And the food at first was all canned food, and it wasn't very good. But we had an agriculture project going, and finally... we had the farm people of Heart Mountain map out and clear the land and plant crops so then we could have fresh vegetables to eat. And that was really a boon to us.
And that was actually your husband, whom you met at Heart Mountain, but he planted those crops so that you could have fresh vegetables.
He was an agronomist, so he... soil tested the grounds of Heart Mountain and decided where each crop would be planted. And in fact, he told them to plant the daikon and carrots, the root vegetables, near the Shoshone River where they would grow better. And things like that. And it really was a boon to the camp that we could have fresh vegetables.
And you know, Toshi, I want to ask you, because it's often overlooked that one of the hardest parts of this experience, the internment experience, was actually returning to your life back home.
Yes.
What did you find when you and your family, your parents, you returned back home to Los Angeles?
Well, fortunately, we did not sell our home, and but we had rented it. And our renters would not leave. And so we finally had to get the sheriff and have them evicted. And so our tenants were so angry, they vandalized our furniture before they left and took a few things. And so that's what my mother and father went back to.
Well, they struggled mightily, I know. Your mother pretended she was Chinese in the markets to get by. I know your father especially struggled most deeply with the return. Would you tell us what happened to him?
All right. My parents went back before the war ended. They went back in January of 1945. The war wouldn't be ending until August of that year. And so the neighborhood people knew we were Japanese. So when my mother went to the grocery store to buy her groceries, they said, "We don't sell to Japs." So my mother had to take a bus and a streetcar and go down near Chinatown to the Grand Central Market down there and hopefully pass for a Chinese woman to buy her groceries. So she had a rough time.
And your father?
And my father couldn't find work, and we were running out of money. And my father tried physical labor, but he just couldn't do it. He was a life insurance agent before the war, and so he went to the insurance company, but they wouldn't reinstate his license. And so he had a nervous breakdown, and he knew that, and well, he had paid the premiums on his life insurance policy, and he knew if he committed suicide, he didn't buy that policy with that intention. So he knew that they would pay my mother. So that's what he did. He committed suicide. And, but, it had to go through, the will had to go through the probate court, and so it took almost 2 years for the probate to come through. In the meantime, we had to sell our Buick that we had stored during the war, and all his steel file cabinets, and typewriter, and adding machines. And we just barely got by paying our bills. Sorry.
Shirley, let me just ask you about the psychological impact. I know this is something that, as part of Heart Mountain, you want to study the impact of these lives on these families and what happened because of what happened at Heart Mountain.
Yes. As a matter of fact, we did explore that over the weekend. We had brought in legal experts. Actually, Judge Lancito, Toshi's son, came out and gave us a legal perspective. And Dr. Melba Vasquez, who's president of the American Psychological Association, shared with us how families do react with extreme racism and bigotry and issues like that. What I really hope, and I hope all of us will look towards the future, is how can we examine the experiences of the Japanese Americans, you know, in terms of how they were able to survive and develop good practices for our community on what we should not do during wartime hysteria. So I think the psychological aspects are very important to research because we've been very quiet about it. Right. So I think it's now time to talk.
I've got to get to the phones. Here's Brian in Bedford, Massachusetts. Hi, Brian. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jane. Great show, as always, between you and Tom. It's a great 1-2 punch. I'm 50, no Japanese blood. I first learned of this by accident, literally in high school when I was 18, and wound up studying it, independent study, as an advanced placement high school student, and it still resonates with me 32 years later. I want to bring up 2 points because I know time is short. One, Earl Warren was actually a proponent of the relocation, and he surprisingly, as Attorney General in California, and he went on to become one of the most liberal Supreme Court justices. And two, that there was actually an effort towards relocating the 150,000 Japanese Americans in Hawaii, and that basically stalled because the local government said it just wouldn't work. And they represented roughly a third of the population of Hawaii at the time. Mm-hmm. And just the incongruity between relocating everybody in California and up along the coast, and if they were posing a real risk to leave one-third of the population in Hawaii, mm-hmm. it's just absurd. So there's a lot of politics involved mm-hmm. also. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate those insights, Brian. Thanks for your call. Here's Joseph from Corbin, Kentucky. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to On Point.
Hello. My comment is it was a tragedy to begin with. But if a lot of from what I can understand about history, and I study a lot of World War II history, from what I can understand, if it wasn't interned, I mean, I know it was a tragedy, but if they were interned, they would have probably been mass murder in the country. But you also have to look back and say this. They was units, military army units, Marines formed from the Japanese, and they fought in the European theater against the Germans, which, you know, a lot of people don't realize that they contributed a lot. But what I'd like to say is I'm very sorry that it happened. And I know that it should never happen, but President Roosevelt, after he seen the deer in 42 and 43, he realized that he needed to do something with it, and that's what he done. He formed units out of them, and they distinguished themselves in the war.
Let me ask Erica Muller about that. Joseph talked about the public sentiment. What was it at the time, and how did the public respond to these the roundup of these Japanese Americans?
Well, as a general matter, the public was along the West Coast was quite happy with the roundup of Japanese and Japanese Americans. In fact, significant segments of the population along the West Coast had desired that the Japanese not be permitted to immigrate in the first place, and had worked for decades to try to get them out. So there was not any upswell of opposition, strong public opposition anywhere in the country to this program, with some very modest exceptions. The Quakers were articulate spokesmen against it. American Socialist Party spoke out against it, and there was even opposition within the government. The Justice Department thought that this program was completely unnecessary and illegal. But as a general matter, Joseph is certainly right that there was great mistrust directed against people of Japanese ancestry. I would like to correct one small thing that Joseph said early in his comments, most of which I think were outstanding. He talked about the risk that Japanese Americans would have been mass murdered or been subject to vigilante violence along the West Coast if they had not been incarcerated. There really isn't any evidence to support that in the historical record. And much more to the point, if this really had been about protecting Japanese Americans, then one would have expected that the searchlights at Heart Mountain and the weapons of the military sentries would have been pointed outwards towards the surrounding communities to protect the Japanese Americans inside. But in fact, the searchlights and the weapons were all pointed in. So it's just not accurate historically to say that this was a measure taken to protect Japanese Americans.
Here's another call from Kentucky. Berea, Kentucky, Alice is on the line. Hi, Alice. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Well, I have something that I think may be a unique perspective on the relocation centers.
Yes, please, quickly.
I was born in one in Arkansas. My parents were Southern Baptist missionaries to Japan pre-war. Hmm. And we're Anglos. Hmm. But I've long wondered, this was in Roar, Arkansas, and my parents were living in a town between the two relocation centers. Their landlady sold the house because of her resentment of their work with the Japanese-speaking people. And the government came and asked my mother if she would teach. And she said, well, I'm secondary, not third grade, is what they wanted. They said, but we're desperate. And I'm pregnant, but we're desperate. So my family had a place to live, and I was born in the relocation center. Mm. I have the Red Cross yearbook from that year, and there is a group picture of the Federated Protestant Church, and there's my father right in the middle of that group there. Mm. And I've wondered, I don't know whom to contact to find out if there's anybody else in my circumstances as having been born in the relocation center, as many
I'm sure
there's American babies were.
I love your story, and I'm glad you called, Alice. I'm sure there's a resource at the Heart Mountain Foundation. Shirley Ann, give us your thoughts as we conclude here. What does Heart Mountain mean to you now?
I think Heart Mountain means the future. I think if we look at Mineta, his experiences, as well as Al Simpson's experience, I think we need to look both at the Democratic and the Republican side to try to work together as a community. I think that this is an example of how we can work together and move to the future. And I'm very grateful to the state of Wyoming and the locals, and I'm so grateful for the Japanese Americans that were there. But I think this really exhibits teamwork and sustainability for the future. And that's what I see.
Eric Muller, we have so much we haven't gotten to, including the 800 men from Heart Mountain who joined the Army and fought in Europe in the war, leaving their families interned. Their unit was one of the most decorated units in military history. The redress movement of the 1970s and the apology that came to the Japanese Americans who were interned during that time. What do you take away as a historian and having studied this for so long?
Well, I'm constantly astonished by the number of stories that have yet to be uncovered from Heart Mountain. There's also the story of the young men who resisted the draft at Heart Mountain rather than complying with it in order to create a test case, and just countless other stories. I think that the Heart Mountain story is a very, very important lesson in scapegoating. The tendency of all people, not just Americans, during times of crisis to turn inward and to begin to look askance at people who come from a different cultural, religious background, to speak a different language, what have you. That's something that was with us 60 years ago. It's with us today. It's going to be with us, I think, as long as we're human beings. So visiting Heart Mountain might help us resolve not to make these kinds of mistakes again.
Toshi Ito, we only have about 30 seconds. I wish you would tell people what you want them to know about your experience at Heart Mountain.
I want them to know that this
history of ours should never be repeated again. So I'm so glad there is such a museum to teach this lesson.
Toshi Ito, joining me from Laguna Woods, California, former internee at Laguna at Heart Mountain in Wyoming. Thank you so much for your time, Mrs. Ito. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Shirley Ann Higuchi from Salt Lake City, chair of the Heart Mountain Wyoming Board of Directors, has spent so much time and effort and energy and money getting this center together. Shirley, thank you for your efforts.
Thank you, Jane.
And Eric Muller, joining me from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who has studied this for his life, a professor of law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.